I want to start this sermon with a scene from a movie we've visited before, a different part of the movie, but it's one that, again, will be familiar to many of you. In the Karate Kid movies, Mr. Miyagi is a picture of calm with an anxious student, Daniel. Daniel wants revenge, and Miyagi is calm and measured. Daniel wants to hurry on and get to fighting training, and Miyagi is all wax on, wax off. You know, Daniel is full of angst, and Miyagi is full of restraint, which is why it's jarring to us to see, I guess it's technically at the beginning of the second movie, but it really is at the end of the first movie's story. It's so jarring to see Mr. Miyagi with Sensei Kreese pinning him in the parking lot after the tournament. And we wonder, is the good guy about to go bad, or is the bad guy about to finally get his? Sensei Kreese has just spent the tournament instructing his students to show no mercy to their opponents and to inflict injuries to win. And now they're in the parking lot after this tournament, and Kreese is going after his star student. And Miyagi confronts him. And they begin to get in a confrontation, and now Kreese has his hands bloodied from punching through car windows as Miyagi has just calmly sidestepped each one. And Mr. Miyagi's got him pinned down, his hand raised, and he begins to recite Kreese's own words back to him. Mercy is for the weak. We do not train to be merciful here. And he raises his hand and rears back and then honks his nose and lets him fall. And we think to ourselves, was that a moment of mercy? Or was that a moment of weakness? A few months ago, we had a sermon on the Good Samaritan where we were looking forward to our year ahead and the year behind as far as our giving and generosity, and we looked at the story through the lens of mercy having receipts, that it's a feeling that we have towards someone, but it shows up in how we spend our time and money. So we took mercy and we looked ahead. What does mercy start to look like in action? I actually want today to look behind. In this series on gracious and compassionate, and all these words that are getting used and misused, what it means to show compassion, I want to step back from mercy and say, what kinds of feelings and attitudes lead us toward mercy? What kind of heart? What does compassion look like? And I want to do that as we continue our series looking at these important words. So yes, the Samaritan, as we talked about in a sermon before, may have seen this wounded man and mercy compelled him to act. I just want us to look at the sequence that led up to this. So it's just a quick reminder, of the context of the story. Jesus is teaching a crowd of people, and a lawyer stands up and asks what he has to do to inherit eternal life. And there's some back and forth, and they come to an agreement that really is about keeping the two greatest commands. Love God with everything you have and love your neighbor as yourself. And then there's a very practical follow-up question. Who then is my neighbor? That's the prompt for Jesus' story. And in the story, a man is on his way back from worshiping in Jerusalem. He takes a dangerous road. He is attacked by robbers who strip him and beat him and leave him for dead. And two people who should have stopped, a priest and a Levite, well, they don't stop. In fact, they switch lanes and get farther away from the grotesque sight. And now we come to traveler number three, our unlikely hero. Luke tells us that a Samaritan, as he traveled, came where the man was, and when he saw him, he took pity on him. So this Samaritan arrives on the scene taking the same route as the priest and the Levite, but this round will be different because those guys, well, they see and they pass by. And the Samaritan sees, and he takes pity. Now, take pity can also be translated had compassion. In fact, some of your versions might use that wording. It's not a thin word. It doesn't mean he noticed the man and thought, that's unfortunate. It's a gut level word. It's a word that means being moved deep inside by the suffering of another. And when you start noticing this word in the Gospels, you notice that it's almost always used in holy places. In the parables, the forgiving master is moved with compassion. The father of the prodigal son, moved with compassion. Jesus sees a leper, and he's moved with compassion. He sees crowds who are harassed and helpless, like sheep without a shepherd, and he is moved with compassion. Jesus sees hungry crowds and hurting people and sick people and grieving people. And again, the gospel writers tell us he is moved with compassion. In other words, compassion is not a defect for Jesus and the world of Jesus. It's not a lapse in judgment. It's not a moment when his feelings get the better of him. Compassion is one of the ways that the mercy of God shows up in the world. So that means Jesus here has chosen a surprising word for a surprising person. The Samaritan, the outsider, the one no one would have admired, is the one in the story whose inner heart looks most like that of Jesus. Now, his feeling of compassion leads to a series of actions: going to the man and bandaging him and pouring oil and wine on him and putting him on the donkey, bringing him to an inn and paying for his care. And when he finishes the story, Jesus asks the lawyer, who was the neighbor to this beaten man? And the lawyer knows, there's no question. The one who had mercy on him, he answers. And Jesus says, go and do likewise. Jesus calls the lawyer to do mercy, but the story shows us that the mercy begins before the doing. It begins in the kind of heart that is moved by someone else's suffering. Our world does not always know what to do with compassion. Sometimes it mocks compassion as weakness. Other times it mistakes compassion for whatever impulse comes next. And so I want to spend a little bit of time then this morning talking about the two maybe opposite dangers of compassion. The first danger is known by more or less polite versions, but we'll just call it this morning, forget your feelings. This isn't just a dojo problem. It's not just an internet problem. It's a human problem, and it has shown up all throughout history. Ancient Stoic writers would treat pity as sort of a sickness of the soul or some irrational disturbance that wise people should rise above. Seneca, for example, warned against pity as a form of emotional weakness. More recently, the writer Henry Nouwen tells a story about visiting Senator Hubert Humphrey with a few other pastoral theologians. They went to visit him because they thought this person, in their mind, demonstrated compassion maybe more than other political leaders. And so they asked him about the role of compassion in his political life. And Humphrey was apparently caught off by the question. He picks up a pencil with a small eraser, and he said, well, look at this pencil. The eraser is only a small part of the pencil, and you only use it when someone makes a mistake. That's what compassion is like. The main part of life, the rest of the pencil, that's competition. And only the eraser is compassion. That's a haunting image. Compassion is just the eraser, the little add-on, the thing you reach for only after the real business of life has gone wrong. And maybe that's how politics often works. Maybe that's how business works. Maybe that's how the world often works. But that is not how Jesus works. With Jesus, compassion is not the eraser. It's not the little add-on we reach for after everything else in life has gone wrong. Jesus gives us a picture of holiness that can see suffering and be moved. There are those who love to hear your compassion and respond with sentences that begin with, "Well, actually." Look at that wounded man. "Well, actually, I read some articles, and there's not any epidemic of violence against travelers on that road. He must have done something dumb." Look at that family struggling to afford groceries. "Well, actually, have you seen what people spend money on?" Look at those people fleeing violence. "Well, actually, we need to talk about what's going on where they're from." Look at that person crushed by addiction. "Well, actually, choices have consequences." Look at that person who's lonely. "Well, actually, they're kind of hard to be around." Look at that neighborhood where children are growing up surrounded by violence. "Well, actually, crime statistics are complicated." Now, sometimes the "well, actually" may contain a fact worth considering. But facts can be used in more than one way. They can be used to help compassion become wise. Or they can be weaponized to keep compassion from ever becoming mercy. The danger is not in using careful thinking. The danger is using careful thinking as a shield against holy feeling. So let me just be really clear. If we see suffering and it moves us, that is a good and holy and Christ-like response. It doesn't mean that we just go respond hastily and only out of emotion. It doesn't mean that we don't go look for some broader facts before we decide the best course of action. I'm not talking about people who are very compassionate, but sometimes might caution us, "Hey, that response you're thinking of is not actually helpful. Let me propose a different one." I am talking about people who, when you show compassion, say, "You are weak and dumb for feeling that way." So just to remind us of what I said earlier, compassion is not a defect. It's an attribute of God, and it's found all over the Bible. Now, there is another danger, maybe on the opposite side. If "forget your feelings" refuses to be moved, then we might call something shapeless mercy, which is being moved but never becoming wise. I think I've told you this before. In 2013, several tornadoes came through central Oklahoma within a pretty short period of time. There's a lot of devastation, and of course, churches mobilized to be part of the relief effort. And where I was working at the time was at a larger church that was not near all the devastation. So we became a clearinghouse for goods and people who were there to help. And so my job became relief efforts focused for several weeks. And people showed up and they wanted to help. And their hearts were good. They'd seen the footage and destruction. My favorite moment was when a group of guys came in looking like some combination of the Dukes of Hazzard and Duck Dynasty, and they showed up one morning and they said, "We're from Kentucky and we have chainsaws." And I thought, "Okay, we got a place for you. We're good." But sometimes people would send things and we would have to say, "The victims don't need that, and the relief workers don't have a place to store it, and it will take more work to haul this down there and beg people to take it than it would to just send money or wait for a specific need." And so there were some people who were offended by that response because they felt compassion and they assumed that whatever shape that compassion took was right. And we see this all the time. One big event can lead to a wave of unhelpful responses or even sometimes protests. One photo can galvanize people to advocate for solutions and policies that might be unhelpful and counterproductive. Sometimes in a desire to show compassion to one person or group, we end up showing the opposite to a different person or group. So yes, good-hearted people can sometimes have unhelpful responses. So the question isn't, well, should we feel compassion or should we think carefully? The question is, will our compassion become wise enough to help? I know sometimes we think we have to choose rationality or compassion, forget your feelings or shapeless mercy. But it's often muddier than that, and that's right where Jesus lives. You can have a compassionate response to something you see and have a rational solution in your mind. You can believe that a woman is being cornered, shamed, and used as a prop in someone else's religious trap, and still hear Jesus say to her, "Go now and leave your life of sin." You can believe Zacchaeus exploited people and rejoice when salvation comes to his house. You can think a person or group of people is being treated unjustly while still being an advocate for law and order. And you can tell Jerusalem the truth about its coming judgment and still weep over the city. Do not let the world form your categories. Let Jesus. And Jesus doesn't teach us that we have to choose between a soft heart and a clear mind. He teaches us to have a heart that is soft enough to be moved and a mind clear enough to serve. Many of you may have seen the movie Hotel Rwanda, which tells the story of the 1994 Rwandan genocide and a heroic, at the time, hotel owner, Paul Rusesabagina, who shelters more than 1,000 people who are being threatened. And at one point, a journalist comes and he is taking footage of the violence. And he comes into the hotel and is talking with Paul. And Paul thanks the journalist for shooting the footage. And he says, "It's the only way we have a chance that people might intervene." And the journalist, named Jack, asks a difficult question back. He says, "Well, if no one intervenes, is it still a good thing to show?" And Paul, the owner, wasn't ready for that question. "What do you mean if no one intervenes? How can they not intervene when they see such atrocities?" he asks. And Jack says, "You know, I think if people see this footage, they'll say, 'That's horrible,' and then they'll go on eating their dinners." Brothers and sisters, not so for us. If you see suffering and it hits you in your gut, don't ignore it. Don't be embarrassed by it. Don't hide from it. Don't let the world tell you that your compassion is weakness. Feelings aren't always wise, and they're not enough. But the capacity to be moved by another person's suffering is not a defect in Christian character. It is the heart of Jesus. So Jesus sees sick people and hungry people and hurting people, and he is moved with compassion. And that compassion turns into mercy. Brothers and sisters, let us be like Jesus, and let us go and do likewise. Let's stand and sing.